Welcome to Becoming the People. This is a very special episode in our season. This is the Ask Me Anything episode, and we have already been through so many powerful conversations. Our team has really been humbled by your responses, by how many of you have been listening and sharing this podcast. And today we are going to respond to some of the questions that we collected via Instagram to answer today. I'm joined today by Devin Delania, who is the executive producer of this podcast, to ask me these questions. Hello, Devin.
Hello. Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be on the side of the mic with you.
I'm happy to have you on this side of the podcast, Devin. I think it's going to be fun. I think we should just dig into the questions. There were some juicy ones in the inbox. What you got?
So, Prentice, you just spent the past month touring around the country with your new book, What It Takes to Heal. And a lot of the questions were about your process of writing the book and your process of touring with it. And EXO Shanna Weber is asking, what is the one thing you know now that you did not know or understand when you submitted the final book draft?
That's a great question, because I will say throughout the whole process, I knew almost nothing about what the process entailed. Every time I completed one aspect of it, a whole world of new things opened up. So when I completed the final draft of the book, I didn't know how long the editing process would be. And maybe you mean the final, but how many editing rounds I would go through, how many times I'd have to read the book, essentially. I read it so many times. I had to reread it, and I had to think about people's feedback. I had to fight for parts of the book that I really believed in that I didn't want to be taken out. So I didn't realize how involved the editing process would be and how many people would be involved in that. So I learned a lot there. Vulnerability works in a couple ways. I didn't know how vulnerable I would feel to have so much of my thinking and my life just available to people. There was that sense when the book came out of, wow, I have no control over this now. But there was also a kind of loss in that. You know, I spent a year just writing in my house and thinking and talking to friends, but I turned into a weird, creature in my house, writing and reading and, you know, interviewing people at times. That coming out of that into the public world was not exactly the part that I had been preparing for. I had been so internal, and then, yeah, suddenly it's talking to people, it's responding to how they're interpreting the book, it's people's questions and feedback. It became a much more public process, I think, than I had really factored in. So that, and so many other things, designing, book tours, you know, meeting so many people, it's all been new territory for me, but an exciting one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What was one of the most surprising things or a really memorable moment you had from the tour?
At a few different stops, people, you know, brought their kids of all ages, babies, taking pictures with babies or signing books for babies, people bringing their teenagers. I remember, I think I was in Atlanta, and one person said, you know, this is my daughter, and she's really excited to be here, but she doesn't want to say anything to you. So it was really sweet. The intergenerational piece multiple times, I think, was the most delightful part of it for me. People would say, this is for my father-in-law who's going through a hard time, or this is for my mother who wishes she could be here. It was something really special for me about the intergenerational aspect, and kind of surprising.
Yeah, that was really sweet to see from the sidelines.
People singing too. I mean, people sang songs to me and us. Yeah, poetry and gifts. I didn't expect any of that. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah. For the places that I was, you could see just how moved people were by your work and by the book. It was really exciting and sweet.
Grateful.
Okay, our next question is from Louie Katie, and they are asking, how do you practice embodying courage when your body is feeling fear?
This is an important place of practice for me, and maybe for a lot of us right now, especially. I think first I just want to say that there's a lot to be afraid of happening in the world. I feel fear. And maybe that's the first part of my answer to the question, is that I do feel afraid. I sometimes think that people, and maybe this is something about how I communicate or how people interpret me, that people don't imagine that I get scared, but I actually do get scared. I get scared frequently. And I'm also prone to doom scrolling and worst case scenario envisioning when I'm more isolated or disconnected from people. I get scared. This question on courage is something that I've been practicing with for a while. The way that I do it, one, is to not imagine that I can go through such unsettling times and not feel afraid. That's not going to be the goal. And I know that maybe that's disheartening to hear. And it also feels like the chaos of it all is maybe in some realms only beginning. I mean, I think we haven't seen, and not to be doomsday about it, but I don't think we've seen the worst of what climate change will do in our lifetimes. I don't think we've seen the end of what political strife and political violence will look like in our lifetimes. That feels like a grounded assessment for me, and not one that comes out of a kind of fear that has run rampant, but it feels grounded in the moment and the historical reality of this time. How do I practice courage, though, even in that, is that even though I can look out and say there are catastrophes that are present and imminent, there's also still life. And I think as long as I can experience that, can relate to life and aliveness around me, I have a resource from which to draw courage. Courage is, for me, how I reach for life, even when my fear tries to isolate me or take me away from life and living. Because that's the other thing about fear. That's why when we get stuck in it, it can really be a challenge, because it can draw us into isolation. It can say there's nowhere safe, there's no one safe, there's nothing safe, and therefore I should just draw in and close in. But in doing that, in isolating, we cut off the possibility to connect, to do something different, to create communities where we can be safer, to connect to the actual experience of our lives right now. I think my courage is really basic in that way. I feel connected to life. I seek out connection to life and aliveness, and I draw courage from that. And I also feel fear. And when I feel fear, sometimes when I can, despite what my fear tries to tell me, I find that when I'm fearful with someone or in nature where I feel connected to awe, my fear is less isolating. If I can tremble while somebody's holding me, there's something else that's always possible. There's always that reminder of connection and more. So I practice that a lot these days, not letting my fear take me out of connection, but moving towards connection. And I think that's where everything that we need is.
Yeah. I think this next question relates to that fear, specifically around the climate crisis and that relationship that you're talking about building. How do you as a parent relate to the climate crisis? And this is coming from Elliot.
Elliot, this is, in a way, the question of my life. I was ambivalent about having a child because of the climate crisis. I wasn't sure if I should. And, it's not even something you can truly be sure about. I think on some level, as a parent, the greatest fear you have and the thing that you have to reconcile is your children's suffering in the world, because you know what suffering is as a parent, and you love this person and are charged with their care and their development. For me, I could just say for me, it almost has a little desperation to it. I wish that, it was a little more grounded than that, but it does. It's it's intense because you're charged with their care. It's not like, you know, the love you have for your friends or your partner. You're like, I love you, and you're an adult that takes care of yourself. This is, I love you, and I am responsible for your life. And you are always defying the parameters. You're always doing something a little bit dangerous. So what you kind of have to deal with, the existential nature of being a parent, is dealing with the suffering that will come to your child and the fullness of what life is and what they will experience. And I imagine it's irreconcilable. I imagine that I will leave this earth with some of that existential anxiety about my child. The climate crisis compounds that in a way that is just massive for me, because I know that the earth will change. The earth is changing, that people are already suffering, that children are already suffering, that my child might suffer in ways that I don't know or understand. It's, when I look really into it, it's unbearable in a way. And what I'm trying to nurture in my child is an adaptability, is a relationality, that I think are the foundational skills of being a human being, but also being a human being in this time, to be loving and resourceful, creative, again, awe, to find wonder in living and aliveness, to not lose sight of that. And I can create kind of scenarios in my head, but I have no idea what her life will be like. I have no idea at this point how she will love, what she will feel passionate about, what will excite her about being alive, and what will be hard. I don't know. And I don't know that it serves for my fear to create too much that I might then impose on her. But I hope to teach her the joy of living, the joy of life. And I think that will serve us all. We can't live with too much fear. And we also, I mean, I have to say, and maybe this is, I'm not super into astrology. I think I've said that on here before, but I am a Sagittarius. And so I have to say the kind of like irreverent thing too, which is when I see people suffer, that is the worst thing. Death is a part of the package. And a lot of our fear around what's to come is also our death anxiety. Death is part of the equation. Suffering is the part that we tend to create and amplify as human beings, that I don't want my child to suffer, but I know her life will flourish and it will end the same way mine will. And it's painful to think about, but it also helps me manage my own anxiety so that I don't impose it on her.
Mm. I think one of the most beautiful things of getting to witness you and Kasha raise your child is that you have a level of honesty and truth with her about the cycles of life. And she gets to spend a lot of time out on the land, out in the world. And she's so curious and full of questions. And you all are really honest with her about when things pass away, when things decompose, when they go back to the earth. And not every child gets that experience.
Yeah, it's actually the major topic of our household right now is death and decomposition. And you know, it's funny because the first time, you know, a chicken died and she saw the chicken was dead and Kasha took the chicken to go bury it. And she kept saying, the chicken died, the chicken died, the chicken died. The chicken went back to the earth is what we told her. Chickens, their body was returning to the earth. And she repeated it. We actually had people visiting at the time. She repeated it for an hour. And I kept just being like, yes, baby, the chicken has gone back to the earth. The chicken has gone back to the earth. It seemed like almost like a glitch. But at the same time, when I was talking to her, I realized in a way there was something in her trying to reconcile it, because she could perceive the finality of the chicken. She never thought, oh, the chicken's just going to wake up. She looked at the chicken and she knew that there was something really final about what she was seeing. So in a way, I was like, there's something in you that already knows this cycle. And there's something in you that is trying to reconcile the completeness, the finality of it with everything else that's now happening in your life. So she just, I knew that she had to repeat it. It was like 200 times, I think she repeated it.
Yeah.
But she's been very curious about decomposition. We talk about it, about bones and the soil and who inside the earth helps us return to the earth, the creatures and insects and bugs. So yeah, we're very honest, and it's been a confrontation, a journey for us too.
Yeah. I feel like children are just so honest. It's like she's saying it 200 times. It's like humans, you know, adults are doing that, but we're just processing it internally. And it's like, oh, she's just honest. She's working
it
out
in real time.
This question comes from Sturdy McSturdies.
Oh.
And the question is, what does harm reduction look like when you hit your limit and don't want to be a dick to your dear ones? And Sturdy McSturdies is my IG alias.
Are you Sturdy McSturdies? You don't want to be a dick. Well, first of all, dicks are okay. So we don't want to talk down on dicks. I just want to start there.
Body positivity.
Dicks are great. Well, okay. Here's the real thing is that this has been a hard learned lesson for me in the last couple of years. Somebody is going to think that you're an asshole sometimes. And a lot of us, including myself, this is me. I'm talking to me. This is me talking to me. You can like spend all the energy in the world, try to strategize in all the ways imaginable so that nobody ever, God forbid, thinks that you are an asshole. But sometimes because of their own stories, their life experiences, maybe their experiences with you, there may be some people that are like, no matter what you try to do, they're gonna be like, oh, there they go again, being an asshole. We cannot live our lives beholden to other people's image of who we are. You're going to be an asshole sometimes. And so kind of embrace that shit. It like helps you. It's like helping me breathe a little easier, because chasing being the good person, the nice person, the never mean person, you'll still lose. You're still going to be that to somebody. So release yourself of that energy. Act inside of your integrity. But you can't take care of everybody's feelings all the time. And you certainly can't you can't control the story that they have about who you are. Because what you mean to them, what you symbolize in their lives, really sometimes has very little to do with what's inside of you and your own motivations. And it is their process. It is theirs to work out. Now, if your question is, how can I intentionally not be a jerk to somebody that I care about? Remove yourself. I think the times when it's like, now I'm about to be a jerk, if you have that space in between you being a jerk and not being a jerk, where you can kind of be like, oh, here it comes. I'm thinking of the thing to say that is going to slice right through them. If you know that it's coming on, that's often the time to kind of remove yourself. You no longer have enough resources to engage in a thoughtful way with somebody. You can tell them that. You are entitled to your own boundaries. You can say, I need to remove myself because I won't be able to do this in a way that's going to, and that's a lot of words, but you can just say, I need to go. I need to go right now. I need to go. I need to think. I need to feel. I need to cry. I need to talk to somebody. I need to run around, whatever it is you need to do so that you can return. You are not obligated. And maybe, you know, I know everybody's conditions are different, but generally we're not obligated to stay in something or stay in a conversation because someone wants us to. We can leave, remove ourselves. So I would say the number one thing, harm reduction, is remove yourself however you can when you are under-resourced, because that's really what it's about. I'm no longer resourced. I'm feeling hurt, or I've been doing this too long, or I don't have what I need to stay in. Remove yourself when you can. And also remove, if it makes sense for you, the idea that you control how people think about you, and let yourself be not always good. And I think that'll free up a lot of us a lot of the time. I don't know if that's a good answer. Devin, what do you think?
I think that is a good answer. I like what you're talking about, this space between. I feel like the biggest lesson I learned over and over in my life is know what the line is 3/4 miles before mm-hmm. the limit,
yeah.
You know, internally, like know when I'm getting to that limit and then do the things I need to do for myself before I get to that place, you know? And it's, I mean, I learn it 100 times a day, but taking care of myself in the way that I need to take care of myself so that I can be in whole relationships with other people and feel myself at the same time.
It was that lesson I learned early in somatics of like, sometimes you think your boundary is here, but it's actually it was way back here.
Yeah.
You just are used to having it crossed or crossing it. So it's like, where is my actual boundary and figuring out where that is. It's important.
Yeah, and if we're a person that's been socialized or we've learned to overstretch in that way, sometimes it just takes a lot of attention to ourselves to figure out how do we come back in to
That's right.
ourselves.
That's right. Let people have their feelings. Let them have their feelings.
Thank you, Sturdy McSturdy. I have a question for you. This is a time traveling
Okay.
question. One of the coolest things that I've got to witness in the past few years is you accomplish all these big visions and dreams that you had. You got to start this organization called the Embodiment Institute. You had this big dream of writing a book, and now it's out in the world, and people are really feeling it and loving it. And we've got to work on two podcasts together. And I'm really curious about what young Prentice Hemphill would feel or think about the life you're living right now. And who were you as a young person, and
Oh.
how does it relate to your life now?
Who was I as a young person? I was a lot like I am now in that I was a bookworm. I really liked to read and think and study. I wasn't super interested in school, but I was also the kid that would be in the library at lunchtime reading books. So I was just really curious. I could also, I could go from really like, what do you call it? Like insular. I could be really like by myself, or I could be really rambunctious and like, I like to meet people. We'd be out at the mall and I'd be like, hi, who are you? My name is this. What? I could like talk to strangers. So I had both of those things in me, but I could also be really quiet. There's something about like, yeah, I just always like to interact with people. I was really curious about people. And really curious about people's lives. Really silly and kind of obnoxious to my older sister. I think she'd say that. And I mean, I was a theater kid. I feel like that just kind of says a lot. I was a theater kid. I was actually the president of the Thespian Society in high school, so I was like a theater kid. And but theater,
Not surprising.
I know. It was just a way for me to like be with the weird kids, but also theater was so interesting because you got to like climb inside of other people's skin. And I really enjoyed that. It's that curiosity. My child self, I think, reacting to the things that I've done. I mean, the thing about it is like all the things that I've been able to do in the last couple years, I was able to do because of other people, like you, Devin. A lot of the things you named were possible because of you. Your work with the Embodiment Institute, your work on these podcasts and Kasha and so many people. Someone asked me like, how do you do all the things you do? And I was like, it's not just me. I'm not just me. There's so many people that are doing this with me. And in a way, I think that's the thing that would be probably most, I don't know, is it would be the greatest learning for the young me, is that I could reveal things that I cared about and wanted to do, and people would want to do those things with me. I always felt kind of too weird or outside, and I hid a lot of who I was. And so I think that would be the most shocking thing is that people want to hang out and work on creative things together.
Yeah, I think so many people want to hang out with you and work on creative things together. It's so fun. I love this theme of weirdness because I feel like when you and I first met, we really wanted to be friends with each other and we were so weird about
Are you going to
it.
tell the story?
We don't have to go into details here, but we were just, I think we could feel and sense the weirdness in each other
Yeah.
and we're excited about that. And I've heard you talking a lot recently about we just have to get weirder
Yeah.
as a culture. We just have to let our weird flags fly a little
Yeah.
bit. And I'm curious what you think that offers this moment in particular.
I've heard other people say this before, but you can't find your people if you don't let them see you. And, the bonds that are created when someone really sees who you are and you let them see who you are and you really see who they are and don't just expect them to be things, Because a lot of us are like, we show up as how we've been trained to be. And you know, a lot of people don't get curious about the layer underneath, like who, what motivates us, what we really long for, what makes us laugh, what we can't stand. And I think that kind of curiosity, the kind of openness to be surprised about what comes out of another person and what comes out of us, I think it creates a different kind of bond and connection. It's something that I long for all the time. I look for it. And it's like, those are the people that are actually my friends, not the people that kind of like just recite things that they should say or someone told them to say, but the people that can like take the risk to say how they really feel. Those are the people I tend to want to hang out with the most because I feel like I can be safe to be alive and thinking and feeling. So I think it creates actual connection, but I also think it like helps us see new possibilities when we can be weird and you know, and just like question what makes us normal. What do normal people dress this way, listen to this, go here, eat this. It's like be weird. Find out your tastes. Find out, you know, what makes up you. And you know, movies can sometimes create a world of possibilities. Oh, this happens in this world. You know, what's your world? What's the constellation of things that makes up who you are and makes up who other people are? I just find that to be really liberating and that it doesn't keep us compelled towards this normal, but it also opens up all these possibilities for what could be.
What is a thing that makes you laugh?
I'm always making these little dry jokes because it delights me inside. I may not be outwardly laughing, but I'm always finding a way to crack up inside of myself. So yeah, I think people don't get a lot of times my dry humor and they'll be like, oh, kind of taken aback, but I'm just making myself laugh. I'm trying not to take anything myself too seriously. Yeah.
Yeah, that's important.
You make me laugh, Devin Delania.
It's just the biggest compliment I could ever
Oh,
receive
please,
in my
Devin,
entire
you're one
life.
of the funniest people in my life for sure. You are one of the funniest people.
I am so glad we have it recorded now. It's so special.
You're
And
so
it will be the ringtone on my phone from here on out as you sing
You're
that.
so quick. You're so witty. You're so strange in your humor. You are one of the funniest people in my life. I love it.
Oh my God, thank you for saying
Yeah,
that. That's very
of
special.
course. Well, Devin, thanks for being on this episode with me and asking me those questions. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. It's been really fun.
Thank you all for listening to this first season of Becoming the People. We are going to take a break after this episode to rest and get ready for another season. We know that there's probably a lot going on. We are recording this a month in advance, and we know the world is probably not going to get any calmer in the time between now and then. And so our wish is that these episodes, that the time that we've had together can be part of the support that you all have, that you can lean on in these times of really so much change and so much disruption. But remember that we're always in practice together. We're always practicing something. So why not practice being grounded, being present, being open, connected to one another, and tapping into our visions for what could be. Wishing you all the best on this break, and we'll be back soon. Becoming the People is produced by Devin Delania. Sound engineered and edited by Michael Main. Bhavna Nancherla is our research assistant. Our theme song was created by Miata. If you're enjoying these conversations, please subscribe, rate, and especially please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can find more clips of the podcast on my Instagram at Prentice Hemphill. And if you'd like to watch the full visual conversations and help us sustain the podcast, please join us on Patreon at Prentice Hemphill. Thank you so much for listening to Becoming the People.